the prosperity gospel, godliness, Islam, abortion, religious truth claims, scientism, the centrality of justification. You can meet and hear some of your favorite guests teach on these topics at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Collinsville is 15 miles east of St. Louis. Learn more at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois.
After several discussions, offers, counteroffers, the Republican leader and I have come to an arrangement. We will vote today to reopen the government, to continue negotiating a global agreement, with the commitment that, if an agreement isn't reached by February the 8th, the Senate will immediately proceed to consideration of legislation dealing with DACA.
I hope and intend that we can reach bipartisan solutions on issues such as military spending, immigration, and border security, and disaster relief before the February 8th deadline.
That is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announcing a deal to reopen the federal government. It was down over the weekend, I guess you could say, kind of shut down over the weekend. One of the top stories in the news this morning. Who blinked? The Republicans or the Democrats, and what role, if any, did President Trump play in either the shutdown or the ending of the shutdown? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, January the 22nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about the government shutdown, among other things, in the first half hour of the program with Molly Hemingway of Fox News and Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard. We're going to spend some time with Pastor Will Wheaton in part two of our series on Lutheran piety today, not just daily prayer, but he says the daily prayers. And then Dr. Thomas Korchak will join us to kick off a multi-part series on progressive versus classical education. Today, we're going to talk about method-driven education versus content-driven education. You can join us with questions or comments. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc. And the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the government shutdown, Molly Hemingway, a Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, welcome.
Great to be here with you.
And Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome to you.
Glad to be back.
Molly, going into the weekend, you had an op-ed piece printed in the Washington Post, and I think the title speaks for itself, but I want you to lay out your argument. The title was, "I Wasn't a Trump Supporter, I Am Now."
Well, it's funny you say that the title speaks for itself, because I actually don't think that title is the best one for my piece. I did not write the headline, but my piece was about how I had certain expectations for the first year of the Trump presidency, and he has far exceeded them. So when he came on the scene, I was worried because he had a very liberal background, a very progressive background. He had supported bailouts. He had supported Planned Parenthood. He'd given money to Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And when he won election, I was very hopeful that he would nominate a good Supreme Court justice. But I did not anticipate that the first year would be so full of conservative policy achievements as it was. And for me, those are things like getting out of the Paris Climate Accords, not just Gorsuch, who is a really good pick, but 12 appellate judges that are very important judges for the future of constitutional jurisprudence, a general deregulatory approach, and just many things that, the Congress finally figured out how to work with him and passed a tax reform bill. And the approach to fighting wars is not as good as he said he would be during the campaign, but is much more restrained than either of his previous predecessors. So that is what I got to talk about in the Washington Post.
Mark, what did you think about Molly's column?
This is an area of fraught with sort of a delicate footing, I guess. I mean, I you know, I largely agree with a lot of what she's saying. I mean, you know, on the other hand, you know, I don't think we should wave away certain concerns. I mean, I, you know, get it. I don't ever want to be in a position to be defending a, you know, thrice divorced POTUS who cheats on his wives, you know, plural, you know, with porn stars, among other things. I mean, I do believe that personal morality is an important function of public judgment and decision making. And, you know, I've spent the last year or two alternating between being horrified by Trump and perhaps, you know, indulging in some schadenfreude in unhealthy ways. On the other hand, I think what we're seeing here is the relationship between Trump and GOP voters is pretty transparently transactional. I mean, people don't necessarily endorse Trump or like his tweets, but they do like what they're getting out of his administration, certainly vis-a-vis what they would have gotten out of a Hillary Clinton administration. And at the same time, a lot of the reason why I think people are, you know, saying Trump is bad is simply because I think there's a conservative attempt to go out of their way to connect Trump the overall conservative movement and the principles underlying it, even when the two things are, you know, completely unrelated, which is kind of a frustrating debate to be having, because we'll never be subject to endless lectures and debates over the scandalous presidency of Barack Obama, who was a great family man and comported himself with, you know, dignity in office. But as a matter of policy, you know, his administration targeted the Little Sisters of the Poor. You know, he told individual school districts how to work out transsexual issues. He, you know, his administration argued before the Supreme Court that banning books was necessary for campaign finance reform. He was rebuked by the Supreme Court for abuses of executive power more than any president in modern history. And he subverted every U.S. foreign policy interest toward appeasing mullahs and his sort of turnspits underneath, you know, later bragged about deceiving the public and manipulating journalists in this, you know, Iran deal. So I just don't see a strategy going forward where we're dealing with a situation where the Democrats don't try and discredit whoever the Republican standard bearer is. You know, they spent the last few months of 2012 calling Mitt Romney a racist felon, and, you know, that was Mitt Romney. So I can see why people are definitely viewing Trump in a strictly transactional matter. You know, they may not like what he tweets or what he stands for personally, but they can point to what he's achieving on their behalf and see it as better than the alternative.
Molly, so I'm going to characterize your op-ed piece as Trump far exceeded my expectations. But I do want to know, what would the president have to do to lose your support?
Well, there are many things he could do. I am more policy focused, I guess, than Mark Hemingway is. But if he were to advocate bad policies, that would be the most obvious reason why he would need to be opposed. And I do have trouble with his personal morality. I have trouble with his speaking style. I think a lot of it has been misunderstood or mischaracterized, and that particularly, like, there are some good aspects of having someone who speaks the way he does, in addition to obviously quite a few downsides to the way he speaks. But I don't, for instance, I'm not really sure if he's pro-life. I know he says he's pro-life, and I know he has been putting forth pro-life policies. If he were to change and not put forth pro-life policies, that would be a problem. But I guess for me, it's just more policy focused.
Mark, the Senate voted on an agreement today that would reopen the federal government, briefly closed over the weekend. Who blinked?
I think the general consensus among pretty much everybody is that the Democrats blinked. I mean, they did not have a good plan going into this legislatively, and I think the general idea was that Republicans have been blamed, you know, fairly or unfairly for shutdowns in the past, and that, you know, the press was generally on their side, and that, you know, the DACA and the immigration thing, there's a lot of sob stories and things involved, and there'd be, you know, a sort of human interest element that would sort of carry the day. But the fact of the matter is they just didn't have a plan for what they wanted to do. And so, you know, 3 days in, they looked at the polling, and they were, you know, some Democrats were even fairly transparent about that. They looked at the political cost of this. You know, as Molly said earlier today, closing down services to citizens on behalf of non-citizens, not exactly a winning argument. You know, and further, this is, you know, an issue where Democrats have been all over the map on it. You know, really, I mean, you know, if you look at what Chuck Schumer or Hillary Clinton was saying, you know, 20 years ago about immigration, it's night and day. You know, I think they were just caught in a bind and couldn't get out, so they just, you know, took the first exit they could.
Molly, your colleague at the Federalist, Ben Domenech, suggests that the Democrats were counting on President Trump entering the fray and making a bad situation worse. What do you make of its theory?
Yeah, no, it's a great strategy they had, which is that Donald Trump would say or do something ridiculous that would sort of benefit them and get them a way out of this problem that they found themselves in. I mean, the base of the Democratic Party is really extreme and sort of holding the leadership hostage. This is not good to shut down the government that serves citizens on behalf of non-citizens. And they thought that Trump would say something or do something, or they could leak something or do any of their bag of tricks that normally helps them out of these jams, and he didn't. I mean, it would have been interesting had he done it, and it might have made for more exciting news coverage, but he kind of kept quiet and let them sit in their own stew of, and they had to deal with the fact of the very bad election year look of doing what they were doing. And he came out with a pretty big win today.
So it sounds like, in your opinion, 2018 midterm elections were a huge factor in the brevity of the shutdown.
Well, I think that it's on everybody's mind, on both Republicans and Democrats' minds, and they both have different strategies. For the Democrats, they do want to obstruct and oppose everything the Trump administration is doing. That excites their base when they're able to stop Trump. And Republicans need to get some victories for the same reason that their base is demoralized when they're not accomplishing much. We saw the general poll showing that Republicans are doing much better after the passage of tax reform, major tax reform, the first major type of reform that we've seen in decades. And if they could get some more wins under their belt, that will help them, even if historically midterms are times of great losses. And so that's going to be a factor for the rest of the year, is that they're very focused on how everyone's up for re-election in a few months.
A question for both of you. Mark first. Do you think that we might have learned something from an extended government shutdown? Perhaps conservatives might learn of federal government benefits that they either weren't aware of or took for granted. And on the same token, liberals might come to the awareness that life does go on fairly normally after a government shutdown.
Well, I don't know necessarily what there is to learn about a government shutdown, because, you know, it really is a grab bag. I mean, there are certain very essential functions that, you know, do frustrate citizens, but there is also a tremendous amount of things that the federal government is doing that's just absolutely non-essential, and the federal government is, you know, clearly too bloated. You know, it would be nice if both sides would just simply do their job as legislators to make sure that we just didn't even, you know, ever be put in this position. And I do think that both sides need to take a much clearer look on what the, you know, efficiencies can be achieved in the federal government, and, you know, what the federal government is doing that is, in fact, non-essential and a waste of time. But I don't think there's unlikely to be a lot of partisan agreement on either of those issues. But, yeah, it would be nice if we lived in a world where we had competent legislatures and things never got to this point.
Same question for you, Molly.
I am so bad on this because it excites my anarchistic or libertarian tendencies every time the government shuts down. It just seems like a good idea to shut down the government. But I drove into D.C. a couple times today, and there was no visible evidence of any changes to the federal government. And studies show that it actually costs sometimes more money to shut down the government than to just keep government operations. In general, it would be great if our parties were more focused on a restrained and responsible government that was constitutionally based, but that's not happening anytime soon, probably.
I would also add that there is one thing about government shutdowns that you do see, you know, we saw in recent years of government shutdowns, is that federal employees can go out of their way to be unnecessarily punitive, which is just despicable behavior, and I think that should be, you know, cracked down on. I mean, there was that issue where they were closing the World War II memorial to, you know, World War II veterans who had flown in to visit it specifically because the National Park Service, you know, even though it's the middle of D.C., was, you know, technically closed, and they were, you know, keeping vets in wheelchairs who were 80 years old from visiting their memorial. I mean, it's just, that kind of thing does make you think twice about what's going on in the federal government, certainly.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly Hemingway is Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. We're talking about the government shutdown. More with them on this Monday afternoon, January the 22nd. We'll be right back.
When
Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer.
When your family gathered around Die Hard this Christmas, did all the Plutarch make you feel like benighted schlubs? Maybe you need a classical education. St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, is offering a free primer on the what's, why's, and how's of classical education on Sunday, January 28th. The Reverend Dr. Thomas Korchak of Concordia University, Chicago, will preach for divine services at 7:45 and 10 and speak at noon on how classical education truly prepares children for the future. Lunch and a school open house are included. Join Dr. Korchak at St. Paul Hamel, Greater St. Louis's only classical Lutheran school, to learn about
benefits of a classical education.
Find us at stpaulhamel.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Listening to God's Word, daily prayers, frequent and faithful reception of the Eucharist, confession of sins and absolution, good works. Learn more about the life of Lutheran piety in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January. Thank, praise, serve, and obey. Recover the joys of piety. It's written by regular guest Pastor Will Whedon. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call 1-800-325-3040. Thank, praise, serve, and obey.
You can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff, Hans Feeney, Scott Klusendorf, Craig Parton, Will Whedon, Angus Manoogian, and Jonathan Fisk at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Collinsville is 15 miles east of St. Louis. Registration is $120. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the government shutdown. Molly Hemingway of Fox News and Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard are our guests. Molly, I'm wondering about the issue over which the government was shut down, the DACA bill. And what I'm wondering about is immigration is something that the president ran on, I would say, of all the things he promised his supporters to get to work on and accomplish things on, perhaps next to judges in the minds of some evangelical voters, immigration was probably the biggest one. What has to be delivered there?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. I think with his base, they really genuinely want a wall. It must be a brick and mortar, or something, a very physical wall that will secure the southern border in some large part. But in general, I think you've had a large movement of Americans who are concerned about national sovereignty. Obviously, this is a country that loves immigration. A lot of us come from families with immigrants, or we are immigrants, or we're children of immigrants. We like immigration, but we also know that you have to be really smart about how you handle immigration. So there's this large movement of people who are concerned about borders, are concerned about border security, and an immigration policy that makes sense and helps people who are citizens as opposed to hurts people who are citizens. A lot of our current immigration policy benefits elites at the expense of lower classes, the type of immigrants that come in are competing at the lower end of the income scale in ways that can be genuinely harmful for American citizens. And that hasn't been a thought that has been like respected or paid attention to in a lot of elite corners, whether that's the media or in political circles. And Republicans have been almost as bad at caring about those non-elites who have different views on immigration as Democrats. And it was a big factor in the election. As far as what needs to happen, I think that Donald Trump likes to portray his immigration policies as more extreme than they actually are. You know, he talks about the problems with chain migration, which is where families come in after one person who's eligible makes it into the country. He actually doesn't want to end chain migration. He just wants to change it from being like the dominant way by which people come into the country, but not end it completely. So I think what we're going to see, or what we're going to have to see, or people are really going to riot and rebel against Donald Trump, is serious border security, including at least some kind of wall. And change to our immigration policy that makes it more like Canada's or Australia's, where people are matched for entrance into the country based on their chance of success, based on their education level, skills, language skills, job prospects, things like this, so that it's not, you know, the big problem with our current immigration system is it doesn't match well with the welfare state that we've become. And so things to clean that up and help just help make more sense out of our policy would be necessary.
So let's talk a little bit about the president. There was a fascinating piece in the Columbia Journalism Review by Kyle Pope, the editor-in-chief there, that came out this morning. It was titled, "It's Time to Rethink How We Cover Trump." If you haven't read it, it's amazing in a lot of ways. He is calling the press to kind of hit the reset button and stop letting the president control not only the news cycle, but what they talk about incessantly. What do you think of that, Mark?
I mean, look, the idea that Trump is controlling the news cycle is a bit overblown. I mean, yes, it is true that the media immediately pounce on whatever it is that Trump tweets, and to some extent that does set what sets what happened. But very often, the news cycle is then dominated by a complete overreaction by the press. So, you know, they're controlling it in their own unhealthy way. And so, to me, it's time for the press to sort of step up and take responsibility, not to, like, take back things from control of the news cycle from Trump. I mean, you know, that's a bit of a ridiculous framing for what is happening. I mean, the real decision to take back control of the press from Trump would be simply to, you know, report on the substance of the policies and things that he's doing, and report at least the reaction to what he says, even the crazier things, with a degree of sort of even-handedness, that instead of, you know, absolute hysteria, you know, telling us this is not normal. Well, I think the most healthy thing for everybody involved, and in fact, you know, the most, you know, best way to sort of combat Trump's hysteria would be to, in fact, normalize him, and instead of running around like a chicken with your head cut off saying that, you know, every, you know, stray utterance, you know, is going to be the death of the Republic, when the reality is it's just, you know, something that he said one time on Twitter that may or may not have any impact.
Molly, I've often wondered if the president stopped tweeting for a week, I think the most angry group of Americans would be the press.
Yes, they do seem to enjoy those tweets and almost feed off of them and need them to figure out how they're going to arrange their day. I like the idea of being less focused on tweets and more focused on policy. But if we're talking about not covering the tweets or trying to control the narrative, which is what I kind of worry about this article that you described, I look forward to reading it, and I'm not sure exactly what his argument is. That's part of the problem. I mean, I think Donald Trump is the result of frustration with a media that tried to control the way people think about things and control what they're allowed to read and how they're allowed to think about what they read. And in general, the media would be well served to be a little more humble about their vocations and more focused on what their vocations are and what they're not, you know, just sharing news for people who don't have the chance to be everywhere that journalists get to be, but not about telling them what to think or how to think about it. That's a big part of the reputational problem that the media have, and I do think it's important to have a strong media that is trusted to hold people accountable. And it would have been nice to have that in the previous administration. It would be nice to have that now, and for different reasons, we don't.
Molly, before we let you go, I'd like you to compare and contrast another story that came and went this weekend, and that is two big marches, the March for Life and the Women's March. How would you compare and contrast media coverage of those?
You know, it's such a long-time complaint about how the media cover the pro-life march that it almost becomes tiresome to think about. And also, some media outlets actually have improved their coverage. I mean, there are media outlets that don't even send reporters to the pro-life march, but there are some who do, and they find and seek out interesting stories of different types of groups that are there, or different people's stories and how that led them to be pro-life. Where you really see the disparity is in the just and tons of coverage that you have for the March for Women, I don't remember what it's called, where it's a bunch of people who are not pro-life usually, almost exclusively pro-choice, and they get this favorable coverage. You have media outlets streaming it live. You have days in advance leading up to the march. You have favorable coverage. It turns into this week-long you know, festival of stories. And that's what you don't see for the pro-life march. And it's really obvious for readers and viewers where reporters' political allegiances lie when they make those different kinds of news judgments.
Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
You can read their columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Will Wheaton. We started last week a series with him on Lutheran piety. Today, we're going to stay on that subject and move from being immersed in the Word of God, particularly on Sunday morning, to what he calls the daily prayers. Not just daily prayer in general, but the daily prayers. We'll find out what he means by that right after this.
In just a few short years, digital technology has revolutionized the way we live, work, and interact. But what does this mean for the church? In its January issue, the Lutheran Witness magazine looks at digital technology through Lutheran eyes, examining social media, online evangelism, podcasting, and the spiritual implications of these technological innovations for Christians. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Located 10 minutes north of Worcester in the heart of liberal Massachusetts, Trinity Lutheran Church in Clinton is a solid, orthodox, confessional, liturgical outpost of the Missouri Synod, where God's word is not changed to agree with the latest social trend. No megachurch fog here, just the law and gospel, every Sunday at 10 a.m. Come join us and check us out at trinitylutheranclintonma.org.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Answering objections defending the faith, evolution or creation, transgenderism and homosexuality. These are some of the issues addressed at the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 3rd, at Faith Lutheran Church in San Antonio, Texas. Learn more at worldviewsa.org. This conference features Issues Etc. guests Dr. Jan Lohmeyer and Pastor David J. Weber. The San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 3rd, worldviewsa.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.